The New York Times has led the charge in exposing the obstacles women face in the workplace. From factory floors to Hollywood sets, women have bravely shared their stories, helping to raise urgent questions about gender, power, and policy. Now is the time to find solutions. This September, The Times will convene leaders for the inaugural New Rules Summit, where participants will explore the new rules of leadership for a new era. Learn more at www.newrulesummit.com.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your divine feminine of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Kiss.
Hey, Kool-Aid and frozen pizza. It's the work of art, I ain't talking Mona Lisa. Dream of rocking crowds, see me filling up arenas. It's got me laughing like a damn hyena. Yeah, I live a life pretty similar to yours. Used to go to school, hang with friends and play sports. Every single summer taking trips to the shore. And that was all gravy, but I knew I wanted more. Ain't ever seen a young rapper like one. Can't believe they asked where it's just a mirage. Still got my training wheels in the garage. But I ain't gonna need those, I'ma go hard. So far, I've done pretty well for myself. Couple trophies on the shelf, so what else could I want that I don't have yet? Well, a little more cash in my own fast jet, so I can go anywhere,
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 anywhere.
Cali for the boy, I know there's plenty there. About to be in music stores everywhere, but not yet. They can't understand my concept. I've been climbing up the Great Wall, haven't had a fall yet. These blogs gotta know I'm on next. Clean conscience, good Samaritan. Company sent me clothes, so I'm wearing them. If you didn't know, well, I'm from the burg. Everything I drive.
That is Kool-Aid and Frozen Pizza off of Mac Miller's Kids mixtape. As I'm sure many of you know, Mac Miller died last week. He was 26 years old, died of an apparent drug overdose. It's been a really tragic and toxic year to care about hip-hop and to care about young rappers. And I wanted to make sure that we did right by Mac. And so this episode, I've got a bunch of folks in the studio who have thought hard about Mac's career and were friends with him also. And I want to go back over the arc of the last 7 or 8 years and really kind of not just talk about his music in an isolated way, but also talk about a lot of the larger trends and movements that were happening in the genre that his music either set off or intersected with. So, starting off, it's the real Eric and Jeff Rosenthal. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Eric and Jeff are hip-hop sketch comedians. They are the host of the podcast, A Waste of Time with It's the Real. They are the authors of a book called Rhyme Book that just came out. And they also crucially appeared on Mac Miller's TV show.
We did.
Mac Miller and the Most Dope Family, which appeared on MTV2 in 2013.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. To my left, Sheldon Pierce.
Hello, world.
Sheldon's back. Second time on podcast. Sheldon's a contributing writer at Pitchfork and wrote about Mac's career recently. And to my right, first time.
Hello.
Eric Renner Brown. Eric's a freelance writer, Entertainment Weekly, Vulture, Rolling Stone, and so on. Also wrote quite well about Mac Miller's career. So look, we're going to start chronologically and we'll kind of work our way forward. We started podcast with Kool-Aid and Frozen Pizza, and that is off the Kids, aka Kick an Incredibly Dope mixtape. that was not the first Mac Miller mixtape, but it was maybe the one that drew the most attention. And actually something that I think came up in your piece, Sheldon, that I felt like we should get on the table early is something that I was never 100% comfortable, but was a discourse around Mac, which was like frat rap. And now this was a moment where that was a real thing. Shouts to all my real Cam Meekins heads out there. You know where you're at. Probably binge drinking or doing something really unfortunate. But that was a real moment. There was a moment where if you were a white rapper, a way that attention, you that was a quasi subgenre. I personally never felt that Mac totally neatly fit into that, but I feel like you mentioned it in your piece, specifically in regards to this era of him. And I wonder if you can talk, first of all, about what the music was like in this moment in Mac's career. So this is 09, maybe, into 10?
Yeah, into 10.
Yeah.
I think the Kids came out the summer of 2010.
Okay.
This was like post Asheroff, I Love College. And so over the course
Scooter
of that
Braun
next
High.
Year.
Scooter Braun High.
Over the course of that next year. There were a bunch of rappers who came out in that same vein, rapping specifically to college kids, specifically to white college kids who were sort of using this music to soundtrack frat parties. And so the term frat rap.
I wouldn't know.
Right?
Never set foot in a frat party. Right. I do not know.
Oh, what sorry. Secret societies.
Okay. No comment.
Yeah. So frat rap was sort of this thing that started happening late 2009 into 2010 with Asher Roth's I Love College.
You mean John Caramonica profile subject, Asher Roth?
There you absolutely, 100%.
I was on the road plug. I went on the road with him in Pennsylvania and Scooter Braun. I was in a car with Scooter Braun for like a full day.
Who was driving?
I was driving. New York Times ethic rules. I have to drive. I have to rent the car and I have to drive. So anyway, that was an OG Scooter Braun moment. But yes, continue, please.
And so frat rap was sort of this movement that sprung up in the aftermath of that. That was catering directly to white college students and the frat parties that they were having.
I wouldn't know.
And Mac Miller, he didn't really slot in perfectly with the music that was coming out during this time, but his music sort of came out right as this hailstorm was happening. And
the Hurricane Florence of its day.
Exactly. Yeah. And people sort of had a bad taste in their mouth from that.
Yeah.
And so it was natural to sort of put that upon Mac also. He was a white rapper. But
no Cam Meekins.
No Cam Meekins.
All my real Cam Meekins said. They know what it is.
But it was close
to the hive.
Yeah, right.
It was close enough that if you weren't a careful listener, you could say, oh, here's this guy in the aftermath of Asher Roth doing this thing that all these other white rappers are doing right now. And so he sort of, from the jump, got unfairly hit with this tag.
Yep.
And it kind of stuck with him throughout his career. It was something he was working to sort of shed throughout his career, which is one of the reasons I think he pushed so hard in subsequent releases to show that he was really about this rap life. I think the perception about a lot of the rappers from that time was that they were just like, it was getting in to get on quick and take advantage of rap and then get out. And Mac very clearly, as you can see from the rest of his career, was somebody who was very passionate about rap music, no matter what. And it was sort of unfair to him to lump him in with these guys who really didn't care about the culture.
Anyway. So if you think about that time, this is like just getting into peak blog era.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And I think that...
We're gonna dial in. We gotta call an SK.
Yeah, totally.
You know.
Shout out to the entire New Music Cartel.
Oh, my God.
To Jazz One and everyone.
Oh, to Jazz... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you know, there was this idea, I'm sure, John, you ran into it at certain points, too, where it's like, if you're a white guy who loves hip hop, it's like the Highlander. There can only be one, right?
Right.
It's just you. And so, unfairly, anybody else who comes in your lane is like, well, I already don't like you. And that happened to us.
You realize that this is only one of us leaves this room.
No, for sure. For sure. After a nice conversation.
Yeah.
But you know, so we came into this and we didn't like Asher Roth from jump, right? We had a problem with him without even like
bars. Yeah. And then
we had this idea of who Mac Miller was before even hearing his music, before even meeting him. Mm-hmm. And by the way, some of that negative feeling was valid for a lot of these guys who were out here.
Sure.
But when we met Mac Miller, Jeff and I had gotten a job with MTV to do these absurdist interviews where we ran around and would go to festivals. We went to Governor's Ball, and Artie Pitt, who was working with him at Rostrum, had contacted us and said, hey, will you interview this kid? And I think we reluctantly did so and went in there, and we fell in love with the kid. He was not like the others as a person, as an artist. He shared the same sense of humor and understood what the perception was of him, and that's as a young kid too. And I think that stuck out to us as something different, and we wanted to rally for somebody who understood his place and knew he wanted to be better than that.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I remember vividly, maybe from like a slightly later part of his career, but when he was being interviewed, maybe post Blue Slide Park or, you know, first into second album, he always talked about Big L, and that's like my sweet spot, you know, that's like one of my most important rappers of all time. Very formative on my idea of what rap music should sound like. And
had it tatted on his arm.
Yeah.
And he, I remember he went up to Harlem to like look at the mural.
And then like, Cam like came Cam, to rescue. The story, I think when he told the story, he like posted a photo. Maybe it was on Twitter. I don't know. This was long enough ago that I don't know if it was IG.
Right. Yeah.
But posted a photo.
It was on TwitPic.
Right. Wow. And basically Cameron saw it and like reached out to him. It was basically like, you can't be there. Like it was like in the middle of the night. And he was like,
but how
you can't
awesome
be
is that?
And he just went.
And that, but no, that Cam came to him. Like, that's amazing.
And then they later recorded a project together, but I guess we're
skipping. A song together.
I thought they did a whole project.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Release the tapes.
You're breaking
Release the tapes.
Are there fact checkers of the Netherlands? No. Can we just say anything?
No, you actually can't say anything. At your peril. You actually can't say anything.
At the failing New York Times.
Yeah, it's true. Here we are, failing and inaccurate, but fans of Big L. So it all comes out in the wash.
Yeah.
Eric, when Mac first came on your radar, how did he seem to you as compared, not just to who he had been lumped in with, but also the genre as a whole?
I'm Mac's same age. So when he was being dubbed as this frat rapper, I was, you know, in college, going to parties, hearing him, you know, and that was definitely how I pegged him initially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a lot of kind of pretentious college age kids can be, I was, you know, I was spurning that. And so when I was first hearing him, you know, I was kind of, I definitely did not listen as intensively as I should have been at that time, because I did lump him in and think of him in the stereotypical way.
Yeah.
And that, I think I would mirror a lot of listeners in that way, that followed him, and that listeners, a lot of people took a while to kind of warm up to what he was doing artistically, I think.
One of the things about that era, you know, when you think of that set of rappers, you think of there's a certain aesthetic, there's a presentation, there's sort of the selling of excess. And what I always found curious about Mac Miller in that moment was how small he seemed. And I mean that physically, but also he was so interested in how words went together. And that, to me, when I first heard that, I was like, okay, this kid is engaged in a different kind of project.
Yeah.
He's not engaged in the same. He may, you know, maybe they play at the same parties, you know, maybe they perform in the same places, but his project is different than that.
Yeah, you can definitely hear that fascination with words. Even back in those early projects, you can hear him working towards trying to become the rapper that he would be later on. And that, in essence, is the most important thing, that true love of the craft and wanting to be a better MC and working towards becoming that MC.
And how fascinating that a young man from Pittsburgh would see that as his way out.
Right.
Let me do a pop hit that will get me out of here in a second. Let me do the music that I love. Let me rap on Lord Finesse beats.
Yep.
Let me travel to work with you know, and then take the train to go work with Static Selecta in New York and earn my way up on an indie label rather than, you know, what kids can do now, which is just like throw something out there, hope it gets big and get signed by a major.
Mm-hmm. There's this thing that happens. I remember writing about this a bunch of years ago, and I think this happens specifically with white rappers a lot. And maybe not in the current internet era when like kind of everything is all the old rules are out the window. But I always felt that white rappers had to display a certain degree of fealty. You wanted to come into the game the right way.
For sure.
And that could have been demonstrating historical knowledge. That could have been rhyming in a way that, like, that could have been rapping on Lord Finesse beats, as you say. And Mac Miller, to me, was very much in that mold. Now, the other guys in that era maybe were slightly less in that mold. And now I think that stuff's just basically all been washed out of the game.
Yeah. Listen, we're two guys who totally understand. See, I I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Why? Because he's so much younger than us. He doesn't come from the same background you know, as us. We had very different experiences growing up. We came into the game differently, but why did we get along so well as human beings? And I think part of it was we all understood, the three of us, what it was like to play by the rules and to be accepted and to be celebrated.
Yeah.
And so Mac did it the right way. And there is something about that. There is something about playing by the rules, paying your dues and saluting your OGs and then earning your way into a place where people appreciate your work.
Yeah. And then getting a lawsuit from Lord Finesse.
Well,
Who among us? Also, don't we all kind of cosmically owe Lord Finesse like $10 at least?
Sure. Probably.
Like, if Lord Finesse
What's
put
Lord
up,
Finesse's cash
what's
app?
What's his Venmo? Yeah, like, seriously. Like, I would hit... Let's all, if you're listening to this,
yes, yeah.
hit Lord Finesse with the Cash App, with the Venmo. Hit him with a 5 spot. Hit him with a 10. He's earned it.
That's exactly right.
Even Fatboy Slim, when Fatboy Slim sampled Lord Finesse, I don't think that sample was actually cleared. And if I remember the story correctly, and I don't know if this is a story that is in a publication or if it's in my brain, but
he did a project with Cameron.
Also did a project. No, but I think he basically just gave Lord Finesse like a check for like 50,000 or 100,000 just because that was an unofficial sample. And that's what you did back in the day. You were just like, oh, how do I make this right? Do you want to play the Lord Finesse sample? Amazing. You see, this is a learning process. Let's listen to the Fatboy Slim song that samples Lord Finesse that maybe, hopefully, Lord Finesse got a big check for, which is called The Rockefeller Skank, which was a big hit when I lived in London in some point in the late 90s.
This is Sam Sifton, food editor of the New York Times. Whether you're just starting out in the kitchen or looking to up your game, NYT Cooking is here with more than 19,000 times-tested recipes and all the help you need to cook them well. Subscribe today at nytcooking.com/podcast.
So let's pick up with Mac after the Kids mixtape, although there's other good stuff on the Kids mixtape. Nike's on My Feet.
Great song.
Really, really good song. So the first...
Why wouldn't we play that song?
Fine.
I'm just saying, it makes more sense to play a Mac Miller song than a Fatboy Slim song that's so tangential to the whole conversation.
That's fine, though, but Popcast is a living, breathing thing.
There also, you your throw that I was living in London at the time.
This is what I do. Have you never listened to Popcast? Okay.
You know I don't support your
art.
And
we're keeping all this. This is an off. Oh, this great. Is actually staying on the Popcast. All your doubts.
Yeah.
All your subs. Mm-hmm. All your subs.
Really
Nikki
subs.
You're like Nikki with these subs. Yeah. Shots fired. Nikki with these subs. Okay. Talk about a waste of time.
SoundCloud.com/waste of time.
Getting back to Mac Miller. After Kids. So eventually what happens is he signs. I don't know if he was already on Rostrum when Kids came out. Yeah, maybe he was, low-key, whatever.
Yeah.
But the first album that he put out on Rostrum is called Blue Slide Park. Blue Slide Park is an actual park, from what I gather, in Pittsburgh, where a memorial was held.
It's really like Frick Park, right? And it's just known for that blue slide.
Yes.
Yeah.
So here's an interesting thing. This album, when it was released, was not received particularly well.
By what publication?
I don't want to name a publication. And I know Sheldon didn't
Sheldon,
write.
Did you write there?
Sheldon did not write that.
That was
review.
Before my time.
That was before. Sheldon's not claiming that. You don't have to claim everything your publication has ever done. Just as, for the record, you don't have to claim it.
Yeah.
That record was not necessarily well received critically. But it did debut at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. And I remember...
1.0.
Yes. Good call. I remember, even as someone that was aware of Mac Miller, being surprised at sort of the potency of his fan base.
Yeah.
I also remember, I think when I wrote about that record, if I'm not mistaken, I wrote about it as part of a larger notebook that also took in Wale, J. Cole. You had a sort of like blog 2.0 era kind of rapper. And this was all happening when we talk about Mac's intersections with other movements in hip hop. When we think of the late 2000s into the early 2010s, a lot of time what we're thinking about in hip hop is we're thinking about Southern rap. Like we're thinking about stuff in terms of like what's getting played on the radio, the directions that things are going. But what was happening is that the blog era was helping to prop up a slightly different kind of rapper.
For one
that was a little bit more of a formalist, a little bit more of a traditionalist. And so when you look in that framework, Mac actually fit really well with like a Wale or a Cole.
Yeah. You know, J. Cole isn't just selling out Staples Center and Madison Square Garden for, you know, nothing.
Right.
This is an actual fan base that went out and supported him from like the early Dollar and a Dream stuff.
Absolutely.
And it is the same with Mac and Wale.
Let's listen to something off Blue Slide Park that's close to my heart because of the sample. Let's listen to Party on Fifth Ave.
I think I see where it's going this one, E. Hey, hey, been around the world and
back, yeah, I did that. Still kick raps that cause impact. So where my kids at? And everybody hating, sounding funnier than Sinbad. I'm ill as the pills that they give you when you collapse. This, that, the other, kiss your mother with that mouth. We the kids that she warned you about. We just storming the house, open doors to a cloud. Got an assortment of style, just be sure to this well. 6:30 in the morning and there still ain't signs of slowing down. Twin sisters getting wasted, so they both are down. It's going down, thought I told you, man. If you trying to party, let me see you raise your
hand. There's a party on 5th Ave.
Party on 5th Ave.
If you trying to go.
If you trying to go.
I can be there in like 20. I'm a honk and then come running, cause we gotta hit the road.
We gotta hit the road.
Make sure you got a clean shirt, clean pants, new shoes.
No shoes.
What you buy there, you choose.
There's
a party on 5th Ave tonight.
And that's what I'm trying to do. Hey. What's the difference between me and you? I know I'm believing you. I'm flyer than Beetlejuice. Don't count on a sheep to snooze. Chill, I might eat your food. I partied and sleep till noon. What everyday people do. So wait and see me in boots. Give me a...
So as anybody who watched OMTV Raps in the 90s knows, that sample is the 900 number. And I remember being very struck, again, in addition to being struck by Mac being into Big L, I remember being very struck that that was something he chose to rap on.
He had an amazing collaboration with a good friend of ours named Ian Wolfson, who goes by Rex Arrow, who directed 35 of his music videos.
I saw that.
And that video in particular, that was them dressed up as like old men.
Yes, right.
Him and all of his friends, yeah. Q and Jimmy and all of them. And it showed you that like that was really him. And that continued on throughout his whole life. Like, he wanted to be funny, he wanted to pay respect, but he wanted to show that he could have a good time too. And for your first big single to really take him to number one, to put out a video like that, I think was dope. It's not just a performance video. It was just them riding around dressed up as old men in, you know, these old, like...
It's basically like a mid to late 2010s YouTube stunt clip.
Totally.
Done 7 years early.
Yeah, exactly.
It's basically what it is.
Yeah, but they just wanted to have fun, and they were young, so why not, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean... It shouldn't get lost in the fact that he went to number one. He's an independent artist, and he's a young man.
He was maybe 20 when that happened.
Yeah. I think it was 19. He was 19, yeah.
Around this time, so this is Mac Miller's kind of like in his breakthrough notoriety moment. There was another sort of like historical curio moment that involves our current president. Eric, you want to get into this a little bit?
Yeah, well, Mac Miller put out a song called Donald Trump, and it was his first of two platinum records, I believe, that he would have in his career. And it actually, you know, our president loves to hear his name. He loves to be adored. And you know, this was more of a song, kind of a send up of the opulent lifestyle that Trump would have been living. Allegedly. but Trump took to it, and, you know, he was at first very pleased. He referred to Mac as the next Eminem, I think. And then...
Which is I haven't actually listened to this record at all.
Right.
He definitely never listened to the song.
You know, yeah. I think that there was a thing recently that leaked from like some of the Russia stuff or whatever, that somebody had heard Trump like recently, like years later, listening to that record when one of the people was at Trump Tower with that whole scandal. Yeah. Anyway, though,
I was. Wait, by
the
way,
that's the
that.
Least shocking thing, though, because like Trump loves a good grudge.
Yeah, it's true.
Loves to hold on to like old.
And he was definitely. I remember there was like a Twitter. I don't want to say a Twitter war.
Yeah.
It was mostly one sided.
Yeah, it was just.
But it was mostly Donald Trump angrily tweeting at Mac Miller.
Well, so yeah,
no different than any number of people angrily tweeting at a random person.
He threatened asking for royalties, and he of course did not actually follow through with that. But yeah, no, that was a fascinating little.
Shouts to Lord Finesse.
Yes, that place Slim has a check for you, yeah. Donald Trump. Another interesting thing that was happening, and I feel like it's weird when you talk about an artist's early days, you're as often talking about what they do as you are what they're not doing. And another thing around this time that I think people would say about Mac Miller in this very unimaginative way was, you know, he's another Wiz Khalifa, you know, because of Pittsburgh and because of Rostrum, he's another Wiz Khalifa. Which is insane, because Wiz Khalifa was like an actually bad rapper, like a genuinely like uninteresting, dull, unimaginative rapper. And Mac Miller is actually a thoughtful, curious, whimsical rapper.
But they're both from Pittsburgh, they're John. Both,
yeah, right. Don't you see?
Wait, are you about
to defend Wiz Khalifa?
No, I'm not. Oh, okay. No, Mac is 100% a better rapper than Wiz Khalifa.
I was going to have to ask you to leave.
But
we're
like,
in a new studio. I don't even know how to do that.
but no, the sort of not in the structure of their bars, but in the content of their bars, there was the same sort of...
They like weed?
Well, there was the same
okay,
sort of...
Okay, well, everybody likes weed.
No, it was the same sort of narrow-minded sort of writing in both catalogs at this particular time. And so that's, I mean, the parallel between the two is definitely because they are from the same pace. And you see the two together, you're like, oh, these two are of the same.
Yes.
But there are, I mean, there are through lines there. He's definitely 100% a better rapper than Wiz was at that time and became a great rapper afterwards.
Yeah.
But during that time, people are like, okay, the structure of his songs are sort of formulaic, and Wiz's were very formulaic and basic at that time. And so they're like, okay, these two things are the same. And that's where you get that unrealistic parallel from.
I also want to say Wiz wears great pants and is also way wealthier than all of them.
Facts.
Yeah.
Facts.
And so this record, Blue Slide Park, is a pretty jubilant record,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a big picture way. Yes. But you start to feel a little bit of a change.
Yeah. Yeah, so you start to get a little bit of a change because the last song on that record is produced by Clamps Casino, and that kind of ties Mac in with some other stuff that's going on in the hip-hop community, mm-hmm. you know, noteworthy A$AP Rocky and stuff like that, that you have these kind of like very spaced out, ethereal, I guess, beats that wouldn't have been shared by your Asher Roth and whatnot.
All this Asher Roth slander. I didn't realize. I just want to say I like Asher Roth.
And by the way, later on in life, so did we. We got to know him and we're like, you know what? You're a good guy.
And a good rapper.
Yeah, yeah.
De La White Soul. So Mac Miller has a number one album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Well,
moves to Los Angeles.
Well, yeah, and he recorded a mixtape called Macadelic.
Yes, in between.
And so he came to visit New York. I'm not sure if he was living in Los Angeles just yet, but he hit us up, and we went down to Brooklyn, and he played it for us before it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to it, and we're like, this is really good, number one. And we're like, oh, you're into the Beatles now. Yeah. Like, but it's interesting, too, because, again, you have to think about how young he was. He was a professional guy, mm-hmm. sure, and he's making a lot of money and very successful across the board. But, like, he's like all of us. You go to school and you discover other music. Like, oh, Led Zeppelin was a thing? It's like, so he discovered the Beatles.
Never
and,
heard
and
of
you
them.
Could you could hear that in his music. And he tried to, or he didn't try to. He went in a different direction consciously and evolved as an artist should.
Well, I mean, I do remember at that hangout talking about the 1.0. And I do remember him laughing it off and being, I mean, like, first of all, Mac definitely was one of us in that he knew all the writers. He befriended a lot of them.
Yes.
And he definitely read everything.
Yeah. So there's two ways if people are out there listening and they're just like, well, how do people react to bad criticism? There's two ways to go about it. One is to get on the phone and actually like bully a writer or see them. And the other is to take that in and laugh it off and do good work.
And
also, I think Andrew Nasinski tweeted something on the day Mac passed. You know, Nas wrote the Fader cover on the second full length album, which is
watching movies with the sound off.
Yeah. And I think what Nas tweeted was something to the effect of basically like, I've been talking shit about this guy on Twitter for the last 2 years, and what did he do? He invited me into his home.
Right.
And I think that says a lot. Let's listen to Avian.
Look, concoction of Hamantashans, okay. Launching a bottle rocket. Okay. Done being nice, I'm here for your life and all the profits. I'm not your conscience, you nuts. Almonds and Haagen-Dazs. Auction off your grandfather's watch from the Holocaust. I'm iconic, naked walk in the garden, bird watching, alarming all of these cardinals like I need a pope. Puffing that white smoke. Get faded and play the maestro. I'm ice cold, bunny slippers, nice robe. Sneaky bitch stole my rollie last night, yo. I might know some who can fight, though. Walking on a tightrope, underneath the microscope. But close up, we all just molecules and isotopes. My psychic don't know the future. To live life, you kids might just close your computer. The street lights might blind you though. Make a collage and look at it through a kaleidoscope. There's a bird in the sky. Look at him fly. Why?
So we're in 2013 now, and Mac moves to Los Angeles, actually in 2012, I believe. And this is the first album where you really, the thing, Eric, that you pointed out earlier, you start to really feel it seeping into the music.
Yeah, yeah. You start to really get a sense of, you know, he, first of all, is coming into his own behind the boards. He's starting to do some production work. He's starting to develop an aesthetic. I feel like his rhymes at this point are starting to develop a little bit more of a narrative thrust to them. He's working at themes. He has songs that are kind of addressing. He's really thinking things through. And he also obviously is just coming into contact. Part of this is being in LA, but he's just expanding to working with guys from Odd Future, Brain Feeder, Top Dog Entertainment.
Yeah.
He's bringing in all these other voices. And I feel like it really begins to, he begins to create a universe that's like unto his own kind of.
And then his home studio. I mean, you know, this is something where the Mac Miller residence actually takes on kind of like this life where it's both the landing spot for like, you know, Earl is hanging out there, but also
it's the real. Yeah.
It's
yeah,
the
yeah.
real.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the real. No, that's true. That's true. But by the way, you know, you remember he went down to Miami and recorded a full album with Pharrell called Pink Slime,
yeah.
right?
Oh, right.
Came out. Full yeah. project, never yeah. came out. His choice.
Drop oh, really? The tapes.
Yeah, no,
it was, like to hear
they
it.
Exist, but it was his choice. He was like, no, I don't want to go this
route.
Poppy route.
Interesting.
And I don't want that. To do yeah. just like big records. And I'm sure everyone would have been either appreciated then or appreciated now. And it was like, let me experiment.
And instead he sort of did something in the mold of like Alchemist, where he would just have these hangouts and everybody
Rap
would come
camp.
By and
right.
you know, like while his friends were out jumping in pools and stuff, like everybody else, all the rappers would be sitting on beanbags and you know, in his dank studio.
So by the way, one of our favorite things was,
and I mean dank, not like dank and swag yeah. or whatever strains of weed John's been smoking.
Are you sure? Are you sure that's not what you mean by dank?
Sorry, I've been in.
You
I've
sound
been
like a cop.
I've been listening to a lot of Sammy Adams.
We went to his house to hang out, and we spent a lot of time in that studio, which was converted from a pool house, right? Mm-hmm. But the rest of his house, we always loved this and wanted it to be the case for every other rapper. There was no furniture in there, like literally no
right,
furniture.
That's Eric's dream, is to like be like Joe Budden or Mac Miller.
Yeah, just like every, you know, successful professional rapper has no furniture in their house. But Mac
Any
really,
giant house.
He just had like a TV on the wall, and they didn't have a couch at the time. It was mm-hmm. just like, well, and they had all the plaques hung out in his quote unquote office. It was a very like Scarface looking house with
sure.
like big steps, and the office is right at the top there. And he had a big desk, I'm sure, for all of his business.
Yes, and, a lot of business.
And all the plaques around, but that was it. It was just like he spent all of his time in the studio.
Oh, also they had no mailbox.
Yeah, this
so
is,
we had to. We
how
had to
do
send
you
him,
like? How do you get mail?
Well, his people would have to like throw it over a fence and then hope that he would get
he would
it.
Get wow. It. We sent him one of our shirts and he's like, oh, I didn't get it. We're like, yeah, it was sent back to us. He was like, oh, they must not have thrown it over the gate. We're like, all right, guys. Like, again, a 20-year-old with a lot of money living in a house where his neighbors hate him because everyone's just blasting music.
Right.
And he
in
played
Studio City.
Yeah.
Right across from the Riverwalk or City Walk. What is it called? Yeah. Universal.
The Universal Studios.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thing.
That thing.
Anyway, yeah. but he played us so many songs that had features that he never used. He never used any of those songs. He mm-hmm. was like, this one means a lot to me. Never used it. This one is fairly cool. Never used it.
Yeah, it was probably like 25 songs, 50 features.
And
he was in.
Yeah, and
none
he just
of them
went,
ever came out.
Went in a different direction. So
I think that that's something that's really interesting about looking at his career is that how there were these like multiple like off ramps they could have taken for like more commercial success or to
yeah.
be like bigger. You know, he could have like lingered in the stuff in 2011 with like Blue Slide Park. He could have, you know, gone with some of that Pharrell material, you know, and he.
Or even Blue Slide Park 2.0. Like
sure,
you could
exactly.
have done a different, like basically yeah. just a. I'm number one now. This is what people like. I'm just going to stick with it.
Totally.
But he had this artistic drive that he was like looking to expand and change and mutate his sound in interesting, cool ways.
I think the biggest takeaway for me is that here at this point, you could make a case that he's like the biggest indie rapper in the world.
Yeah.
And his next decision is to go out and empower these other rappers that are around him.
Yeah.
He's like using this influence that he has, and he says, oh, the stuff that you're doing is cool, the stuff that you're doing is cool, the stuff that you're doing is cool, let's all do stuff together. He's putting his resources into these guys, making friends as he goes along the way. And when you talked about earlier understanding his place in the rap
yeah.
culture as a white guy,
yeah.
that's one of those things. It goes understated. It's not something that you talk about, but it's something that you feel.
Yeah. And also, we have to be very clear. The moment that we've been experiencing for the last 4 or 5 years, Odd Future into 2.0, the internet, Steve Lacy, like all these ideas, Earl's later records, like a lot of the germinal moments of that stuff, you can trace back to things that happened probably in his studio.
For totally. Sure.
It was and I dank. Think that's, it was, that it was. But it's, I think it's important to remember that, like, you may not see Mac Miller's name on an Odd Future 2.0 album, but if you trace back the evolution of the sounds, Mac, and when I think Mac and Tyler, like Mac and Tyler and Earl, I think all are motivated by really similar sonic preoccupations.
For sure. Sort of on the same point, and just to give it some perspective, so we grew up 30 minutes north of New York City in a town called Harrison, and
never heard of it.
Bizarrely, it's right by Rye Playland.
Definitely never. Yeah. Wow.
Near White Plains? Okay.
I have all 914 numbers blocked. So I can't.
It's 10 minutes away from the locks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Here we go. There's this video online, and I remember when it happened, of Mac playing his first show at SOBs here in the city. And which is, like, for those who don't know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners do know, but it is a...
Just Google John Caramanica SOBs. You're going to get a lot of articles.
Yeah, it's John's Dank Studio.
Yeah, it's true.
If you're a rapper, you have to go through there. I mean, it's a rite of passage.
It's a legendary venue, and yeah.
Everyone's played there. So when Mac plays the first show, afterwards, there's a video online of these kids from our town who... I think one of them felt like they deserved a credit on one of his beats or something like that. And so they went to go press him. And so, and Mac is just like laughing at this whole thing. Artie goes crazy, which, you know, that's very Artie. And then, and Q and all the friends are there and everything. And so we went from that. That's like kids era. That's blues, maybe a little bit before Blue Scythe Park era, but all this anger from these other white kids going to get theirs from this kid who's just like very popular to Avian, right? Which is a video that was shot down in Houston. We were there for that. Mm-hmm. And it didn't even star Mac, right? It has this like Yogi in it who is spitting all the rhymes. It's very heady. The sound is so different than all this stuff. And I think about what those kids who tried to press Mac thought of that at that time. They were probably like, they couldn't understand it.
They're probably like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Right.
And so I think he was sort of out of sight, out of mind. I think they just probably didn't even regard him. But those kids probably loved the Tylers and the Earls and all these kids.
But maybe weren't seeing it.
And don't realize that Mac was
all of the
piece. A key piece.
Can we listen briefly to one of my favorite songs on the second record, which is one of the Stranger songs, which I think fits into this a little bit, which is G's, which is the Schoolboy Q collaboration.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a minute of that.
White kid, but I'm still bicycling and recycling, and I'm still eating gummy bear vitamins. On my taking Vicodin, huffing nitrogen.
Piper than Williams, middle son. Since I was a little one, moms had to put me on the Ritalin. Made a swish and run, cracked a 40, then I lit a blunt. Told Chuck I had a couple raps, so we kicked the drums. All the best rappers are usually dead, but I'm the poison that left the widow Juliet. In the studio with candles lit and Buddha heads, coming up with all the coldest shh, take your Sudafed.
Contagious, speaking while sedated. Gotcha, make them wanna add a couple pages to the Bible. I ain't got nothing left in my will, except throw it all in the casket, it's mine still.
I need some backpack cast wraps. Took a break just to kill the game half. Set some rat traps, went and took a cat nap. Woke up, threw the dead bodies in the trash bags. Act polite, but I'm nasty on the mic. You be doing my then she has to be a slap her, but she like it. Tell me, master, feed me pipe. I'm the scotch on the rocks, you the apple teeny type. Suck my before I slap you with it. Jeez.
So that's like a real, like, DIT. It's almost like a DITC beat. Like, it's totally. It's
Shouts to Lord Finesse.
Yeah. Oh my God. Does he have to get paid for this too? Oh my God. I'm sorry if I'm opening old wounds. But again, here, working with Q is not yet Q.
Yeah.
But a great example of Mac bringing in the traditionalism that he sort of came from, the sound that he came from, but also importing someone from a totally different scene and sort of helping to push another person forward.
Oh, and that dates back to Macadelic too. I think he worked with Kendrick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was 2012, a full year before
Also, Cam is on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's...
And Sir Michael Rocks.
There you go.
Sure. Sir Chicago. Michael Rocks.
I mean, going back to something that we were talking about earlier about how he would kind of, he was kind of boosting people around him in the scene. That wasn't just in the studio. It extended to his tours. That in 2012, he brought Kendrick on tour as an opener. In 2013, he brought Chance the Rapper out on tour as a rap, opening for him as a rapper.
As a rapper.
Just to mess around. God. But yeah, that was a very important thing that he was doing.
The internet was his live band for the Live in Space tour in 2013. And that was like a full 2 years before anybody was seeing the internet as this entity that existed on the outside of Odd Future.
Right. I remember going to the watching movies, listening, which was that they played this film about turtles, right? While they played the music, it was like, it was an interesting, you know, playback.
Right. And he liked the Beatles.
He did. He loved the Beatles. And Action Bronson came through to show his support and was very action, but it was early, but it was action. And they had collaborated and they were friends, but still it was just like, cool. Like white guys who are both doing their own thing can also get along and show that, yep. Which I thought was like a nice thing at the time.
And their collaboration on this record is good too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
When I went back in the last few days and was really listening through Mac's catalog, like you really see the thing that Eric, you point out, starts really at the end of Blue Slide Park. And I think by the time of the third album, which is Good AM, Good Morning, you really feel the fullness of it. And let's listen to a little bit of Brand Name.
Okay. Yeah. We in between heaven and hell. 9 to 5, I'd rather end up dead or in jail. American ninja to these obstacles, no stopping me, we on the move. Your mouth running like a prostitute's, keep your head to yourself. I work harder than anybody you know. I'm done with tricks, don't need no money to blow. Deadly aim, self-contained, superstar, they yell the name. Blood diamonds, finna go to hell for my chain. A piece fitted on my head, though. I'm too, can't reach me with the cell phone. No goodbyes, no hellos. You don't want this life I live. You rather had a wife and kid. Shooting dice with Jesus Christ for 20 on the midnight. To everyone who sell me, don't mix it with that bullshit. I'm hoping not to join the 27 club. Just want the house with the velvet rug. The world is no one else but us.
So if up until this point, your primary experience of Mac was as a sort of good-natured, formless rapper with a lot of cool friends and like an increasingly murky, aquatic aesthetic sensibility, this is the record where you really wake up to what's going on to Mac as a human being and as a person. I remember listening to this album and being very struck by some of the lyrics on it and the self-interrogation. And it's probably, if I'm being honest, it's probably the first album where I started to worry. And that's a tough thing to talk about with someone who just passed away. But it was definitely the things that were energizing him creatively also felt like they were dark.
So there were traces of this the year before 2014. He released a mixtape called Faces.
Right.
And there were traces of this dependency on drugs, mm-hmm. sort of conquering the sound, or at least heavily influencing the sound. I remember there was a time he tweeted that he was like not, he tweeted that he wasn't on Earth when he recorded most of the songs on Faces. There's this sort of definitely aquatic sound, very jazzy, very far out sound that he starts to drift into. And on Good AM, it's definitely the most personal. His writing takes a turn for the personal where he's like actually like writing about the possibility of overdosing in some of these songs. But It's also it happens to be the point where he takes a real creative turn into doing a lot of his best music, in my opinion. On watching movies, you sort of hear the influence of him being around other great rappers like Earl Sweatshirt and Vince Staples. You hear like this sort of rappity rap trying to get into cadences type-ish. And then on Good AM, he takes the turn into being the Mac Miller version of that, where he's like, oh, yeah, I can rap with the best of them, but this is me also. But at the same time, he's like sort of dealing with these personal demons and sharing those through this music.
And also imagine, I know this is going to sound absurd, but like, imagine growing up in public. And that's the thing, like, we watch our young stars grow up all the time, but rarely do we watch them evolve. And Mac was doing a thing where he was growing creatively, struggling publicly, and changing. Each of these five records, five albums, yeah. or in, if you include the mixtapes, they're all different.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's something, successful, established artists stop doing at a certain point because you get comfortable, you get into a rut.
Every Pusha T album sounds like a Pusha T album.
Wow.
If you know, you know.
Yeah.
No, but this is someone, again, who it's like he went off to college early and never came back, right? He's not living in Pittsburgh. He's living in Los Angeles. And we spoke to him on our podcast in 2015 when he was promoting Good AM. And he had just moved to Brooklyn. And I think out of L.A.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think part of the move from L.A. was centered around the idea of celebrity, right? He just couldn't. And he was very honest with us. This was like on mic and off mic. There was this idea of celebrity that he didn't want to be around, and it became a little suffocating. The idea of who is real and who is not.
Before we go too far down that road, you should, especially you guys, I would like to hear you talk about the TV show.
Yeah.
So in the period of time just preceding, so I think it was maybe just after watching Moves with the Sound Off.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned earlier, there's a TV show on MTV2. It's called Mac Miller and the Most Dope Family. It is sort of a, I think I describe it as a comedic quasi-reality show.
Yes. Right.
And it's about young rap stardom, but in the hands of a person who is either not suited or not inclined to pursue it in the way that most people would.
And surrounded by all of his friends from home.
Yes, yeah. Right.
And
so you guys were on the show.
We were.
Yeah. And you talk a little bit about what that show was like to watch and also be a part of.
It was as fun as one would expect. Like, we were called out there, and I just remember it's done at his house. So you have this whole crew there, and everyone's taking over your garage. So you're sort of like pushed away. And so, again, a lot of our time was just spent in the studio while, like, everyone else was setting up. He just wanted to hang and talk and you know, discuss his family and play us new music and hear about us. And it was still him. I think that you can easily get trapped into the idea of what that all should be. But he was always the same person. Like, it didn't seem like he changed. He was the same guy that we met earlier with more tattoos, with more facial hair, with more money. But it wasn't like he changed noticeably on camera and off.
Right. I mean, like, we never got that impression. Obviously, we heard about things happening behind the scenes, but we never saw in front of our face somebody who seemed to be struggling with something.
Right.
And then also, I think, like, the actual experience of shooting, the scene that we were part of was that we were interviewers, and he was somebody who was a rapper, but he came down with he came downstairs to do the interview in an extremely different getup.
This was at the time, too, where he had a lot of different
characters.
Characters, right?
Larry Fisherman.
Larry.
Delusional Thomas.
Yeah, all of them. Right. Larry Lovestein or whatever. Yeah.
Like, Luther Huckabee.
They all had different sort of things. And then we were involved in another scene where it was at this jazz club in Studio City where he started to perform some of his stuff. And I think too, that was his way of trying to be like, all right, this is who I really want to be.
Yeah.
And this is what the producers are trying to, like, get me to be. Okay, we'll do it a little more jokey for you. But I am that guy.
But it's on my terms.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think about that show, Eric, in terms of something you said earlier, which is the paths he didn't take, about directions he chose not to take, you know, rejecting the Pharrell album.
Yeah.
Like, you think about a white rapper, good-looking kid, could have done a lot of things differently.
Sure.
Not that I sort of experience him as necessarily, like, tanking it on it. You know,
totally. Right.
But it could have been very different.
Absolutely.
I'm sure when they approached him and were like, we're going to make a show about you and your friends, it could have just been a complete, a Tyga show.
Yeah, totally. They didn't envision him and his friends on a fishing boat, like trying, like throwing up on over the side of the boat.
Yeah. They didn't envision when, they gave, Complex gave him a Fisker car, which then broke down on the freeway.
Right.
Which was amazing. But and he gave that Fisker to his father and we're just like, but it's broken. And he was just like, hey, he'll enjoy it, you know?
For the record, the Tyga show is called Kingin with Tyga, which I do highly recommend.
Yeah.
Wait, as Kingin as a verb?
Kingin.
Yeah.
With an apostrophe.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Kingin with Tyga. Honestly, a great television
what
show.
What a moment in time.
I genuinely a great television show. I don't know if it's on the internet, but please seek it out. It is the high point of unintentional MTV music reality content. Fully recommend it.
But
also recommend Tyga and his friend on Fear Factor.
Wow.
Which came out a few weeks ago.
Right. Definitely. Like a worm or something?
Wait, Fear Factor still happens?
Yo, yeah. Celebrity Fear Factor.
With host Ludacris.
Ludacris is the host.
Yeah.
That episode, it was rapper. So rapper Fear Factor. So it's Tyga, Lil Yachty, Cody Shane,
wow.
I think.
Wow. Of the sailing team.
We haven't even. Chanel West Coast.
Wow.
Oh, man. Classic episode. You know it's saved on my DVR for repeat viewings. If anybody wants
you
to come.
You have multiple DVRs.
I do. So if anybody wants to come hang out and watch the Celebrity Fear Finder, like, please give me a call. We'll hang out.
I love how Mac became a touring act at that time, too. You know, he had his own experiences. Again, he's a young kid. He's experimenting in certain things. He's experimenting in his music, certainly. And when he realized that he might, or maybe other people realized it for him, a combination of both. He did take the step of going to Rick Rubin's house
to get cleaned up and
get cleaned up in his own way. It wasn't necessarily rehab, but like it was a dry out and, you know, being under the tutelage of somebody. He just made a phone call to him. It wasn't like he was recommended to him. Mm-hmm. He was just like, let me call Rick Rubin from Europe. And
well, yeah. But wasn't it that he was like a little bit drunk? He called Rick.
Yeah.
It was like 4 a.m. And Rick, I say Rick like he's my
like
friend.
You know,
Rick
yeah.
Rubin.
Yeah.
Rick Rubin was like, hey, why don't you come over? It wasn't like, hey, I need help and I need to come over. Like Rick offered that.
And he stayed there for
a good while.
A whole summer and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but like of all the people to check in with, you know, and he did that.
Let's move forward into 2016. Let's talk about the Divine Feminine. So the Divine Feminine, that's Mac's fourth album. And it's probably the first one where, at least from a critical perspective in my mind, the difficulty starts to outweigh the songwriting. And this is maybe, to me, the muddiest of all the Mac records. Let's listen to Skin.
Said I'm too divine, too divine, who am I? Well, I'm Mr. Superfly, I'm Mr. Bowie, blew your mind, hottest June, July. I wanna make your world so far. Girl, you my painting, you my art installation. Gonna fuck you, put you on the wall. All I wanna do is show you off. I want to put you on, why would I ever blow you off? Right now, let's go get lost. Jed, I've been way too high for way too long, I'm so exhausted. Whether that's your mind or line, we still get crossed. First your man, let's go. Never understand until you have to stand alone. Can I have a hand to hold? A band-aid for my damaged soul. I paint the planet gold, swear Michelangelo. I don't understand it, so. They didn't want a man when it was man. I'm broken now, they on me. Don't need, don't see. It's gonna be, it's gonna be.
I think that this album was a big step forward for him.
Mm-hmm.
He had some really cool guests on it.
Yep.
I thought that his collaboration with Anderson .Paak on Dang
great
is,
song.
Is
great
really
song.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the highest compliment that sounds like something that could have been on Malibu almost, Anderson .Paak's album. And, you know, I
that presumes a lot about Anderson .Paak, but okay.
But I feel like you have this like brassy, soulful element that he's starting to show. I feel like he's coming a little bit out of some of the murkiness,
mm-hmm.
and that his music is getting this energy to it that I feel was even not there quite yet on a Good AM.
Mm-hmm. Sheldon, you bang with this record?
Yeah, I like this record a lot. To me, it's his warmest record. I don't know how that correlates to what was going on in his personal life at the time, but I do know that was the start of the talk about him and Ariana Grande.
Yep.
And they were talking about her being a creative influence. And then you start
On the record.
She's also on the record. Yep. And you start to hear some of the funk influence, as you were talking about, some influence from producers like K. Tronada. It's definitely a shift into a bolder sound as opposed to, I think, the aquatic stuff that he was doing on Good AM.
Mm-hmm.
to me, it sounds a bit more robust. And then obviously there's this focus, the concept of a divine feminine, which he left very broad as being about the feminine energy of the planet, and how it relates to love in the universe and so on. And
he's a Beatles fan. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Also, I realized we skipped right over when we were talking about the first record. We skipped right over the song where he says he's Lennon mixed with UGK.
Yeah.
Hi, Bun. Miss you.
Shout out to Bun.
Yeah.
I had heard very recently, rather, that Divine Feminine actually wasn't written about Ariana.
Yeah, that's
which I found kind of interesting.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I found that interesting also that he did a lot of those songs before that relationship even took place.
Yeah.
To briefly talk about Ariana, you know, there is this moment where Mac does cross over. It sort of, despite what I would imagine were his best intentions to stay out of the celebrity gravitational pull.
I think that's right.
Yeah, but there is a moment, you know, I know he was with his first girlfriend for many years, like during, as he was getting bigger and bigger, but there is a moment where he does get pulled into the celebrity vortex, and that's it with his relationship with Ariana Grande. Let's play The Way, which is the collaboration from 2013, Mac and Ariana.
Do she love me not?
Love me not.
I ain't a player. I
you give me that kind of something. Want it all the time, need it every day. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm at 100. Never get enough, I can't stay away. If you want what I got it every day. You can get whatever you need from me. Stay by your side, I'll never leave you. And I ain't going nowhere, cause you're the deeper.
So don't you worry.
So this is not the beginning of their relationship, but it is the first time you see them together.
Right.
In the video, there's very like affectionate chemistry between the two of them.
They kiss. Yeah. And I believe that she rated it. She rated it a 1 out of 10.
Because is that true?
She said
1.0.
Yes. No, somebody asked her, what do you think of it? And she said a 1 out of 10. And they said, why? And she said that she didn't like how much he tasted like cigarettes. Her reason.
Wow.
So, and this was obviously long before they had a relationship.
Ariana got bars. Really does. But this was something that, especially in this, jumping back to the Divine Feminine era, this is what's happening with Mac in the public.
You know, what's always been fascinating to me is, regardless of like whatever celebrity he took on, and regardless of the fact that he got reportedly $10 million to sign with Warner Brothers, right?
Right. We skipped over.
So he left Rostrum.
Good AM is the first album.
Correct.
As part of the joint venture with Warner.
Yeah. And so he signs over there, and shout out to both Warner and to Mac and whoever was around him. If you think about the three projects, Good AM, Divine Feminine, and Swimming, those are not like major label
rap records.
Sounds.
Not at all.
And I think it's so, excuse the pun, dope. I think it's amazing that he...
Is it the most?
It is the most dope.
The most.
That he put out that product as a major label artist with a lot of money. He chose to do that. And this is the kid who went number one with Blueside Park.
Yeah.
But I think it's also telling just how big of a fan base he had cultivated as an indie artist. Because here he is... He's constantly transitioning over this period. Even as he makes this transition to a major, he's getting even more weird and doing whatever he wants. And all of these records are still debuting in the top five on the Billboard charts.
And I think that's emblematic. Look, Mac is emblematic of a lot of things in the internet era, but it is really emblematic of the fact that, especially as a major label, you're signing an artist's fan base.
Right.
You're not necessarily signing their music. You can maybe can do something with their music that elevates them or exposes them to more people, but you are genuinely signing their fan base. And that's not a knock on all of my good friends who work A&R at major labels.
Sure.
It's not a knock on any of those people.
Brad's sponsors of the podcast.
Yes, please. Anyone can sponsor the pod. Please, I'm desperate.
Lord Finesse.
I know he has one check. When they signed Mac Miller, they were signing someone with a track record. And those people were dedicated followers of that individual. And I think what Mac did incrementally on album to album was carry people into new spaces. He never had like a complete left field turn. He never had like a super overly jarring transition. He just got submerged slowly.
Actually, and even when he did do a left turn, which was like release like a 4-song like EP as like Larry Lovestein or whatever, like,
right,
and it was all jazz. It was Larry Lovestein. It wasn't Mac Miller.
Right. And he did release things under pseudonyms.
Yeah, yeah.
When he did production, he would work. He produced a bunch for Vince Staples. Totally. That's all under Larry Fisherman.
Yep.
Eric, you mentioned those three major label records, which means we're coming up on Swimming. Swimming is the final Mac Miller album that he released. It came out only a few weeks ago. And I got to be honest, this was another album when I listened to that I found it almost hard to listen to. As a critic, I tend not to think of albums in personal terms or in emotional terms even necessarily, but I found this one challenging.
The lyrical content
and also the relationship of the vocals to the production. I felt like there was a lot of submerged vocals on this, and it really hit me hard in a slightly uncomfortable way. Maybe let's listen to Self-Care from Swimming.
I switched to Thumb Zones, but what do I know? Spending nights hitchhiking, where will I go? I could fly home with my eyes closed, but if you're kinda hard to see, there's no surprise though. Then you could find me. I ain't hiding. I don't move my feet when I be gliding. I just slide in, and then I roll up.
Yeah, well, climbing over that wall. I remember, yes, I remember, yes, I remember it all. Swear the hype be too tall,
yeah.
So like September I fall down below. Now I know that the medicine be on call, yeah. Was feeling like you hot enough to melt, yeah. Can't trust no one, can't even trust yourself, yeah. And I love you, I don't love nobody else, yeah. Tell them they can take that bullshit elsewhere. Self-care.
If you were following Mac Miller in the press, you would read his interviews. Mac Miller gave really good interview. Certainly seems that way. I've read a bunch in the last week, dating back a bunch of years, and he was very open. And I think especially sometimes when people are struggling with things, but they're open about it and they talk about it, it kind of like knocks you off your defense a little bit. You're like, well, okay, they know, they're aware. He was someone who spoke openly about addiction. It comes up again and again in his press. And I will say, and it came up in his music as well, this is maybe the first album where I felt the heaviness of it. And that really, I just remember it on a human level, really it concerned me.
Not even like the music. Let's talk about like just the artwork of it. The cover looks like a coffin. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's supposed to be. I imagine it is, but.
First video is in a coffin.
Yeah, the self-care video. Yeah. He's etching inside of it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, obviously something was very heavy on his mind.
Yeah.
You know?
It's probably important to note that, like, I think it was earlier in the year he had the DUI accident and then the arrest.
That was in May, I think. Yeah.
So, and then the breakup.
And the breakup with Ariana came. Although in Craig Jenkins' profile, he says that he wrote a lot of these songs before that happened.
Right.
And a lot of people, the tendency is to assume once that public profile happens that the music is a direct relation to that.
But albums are made over months and months.
So, but they're... There are these things that are happening in public view right up into this music, and you listen to the music and it's by far his most personal, even more personal than the stuff on Good AM.
Yeah.
So I listened to it and I love the album because of the honesty, and I don't know if I can separate that, you know, the art from the person.
Mm-hmm.
I was really affected by it in a way that I was like, he's open and honest. And I think in later years, we took the darkness as just part of him. You know, he's a human.
Well, he made it part of his
totally.
Body.
Like,
and he didn't flinch from it.
No, and I let him know. We hit him up.
Well, he hit us up.
He hit us up, and then I responded and told him that I had been listening to the album a lot, and I did. I thought it was beautiful, and I thought warts and all that it was beautiful, and I think I felt like he was he was trying to push the boundaries more, and I liked that he brought John Bryan in, and yeah. I liked the different
Death
directions
is on this record.
Yeah. So maybe I did separate the art from the human. Yeah, you know,
no, I feel you, and I will say the discomfort that I got from this record, it wasn't dissimilar to the discomfort I got from listening to like the Mount Eerie records that came out a couple years ago. The unvarnishedness, the kind of like direct access to the vein of some feeling like that. And that's not something you get from a lot of records, genre notwithstanding. Like, it's just not something that comes up, but I felt it really pulsed through in the words and it really pulsed through in the musical choices on this album.
Yeah, no, I hear that also, but it wasn't uncomfortable for me because it seemed like this was the music that he was always trying to make, and he was just scratching the
surface, getting to it. Yeah.
So even though in hindsight, after this thing happens, we always go back and look at these songs with new eyes. But at the time, it just feels like his most open work, his most brutal work. It feels like completely self-aware, which is just a world away from the stuff that he was doing on Kids. And so for me, it's like, oh, wow, he finally did it. He got to this place. It's after 8 years of really just chipping away and trying all kinds of things, he finally gets to this place that he always wanted to be. And it felt refreshing for me listening to it, through it that first time.
Like, listening to it, I was also, I got this feeling of almost this, there was this optimism to it for me. Like on a song like Small Worlds, I feel like I've been watching the Tiny Desk concert they did a lot. Thundercat's there, and it just, there's this peace to him, I felt like. And with a song like Small Worlds, he's kind of singing, he was doing more singing, he's rapping, and he's kind of talking about how challenging the world seems, but that he's kind of trying to give himself a little bit of a pep talk.
Before we go, I don't know if everybody maybe wants to go around the table, if there's a particular song or something that sticks in your head that we haven't touched on, I think it'd be good to throw a few more gems in there for people at home.
Jeff and I went to this vigil, and it was in Central Park, and there were a bunch of kids there and some people who were, you know, parents and older. And there was this Bluetooth speaker, and the kid who was running it, this kid named Ramon, who we just met because we saw that he was promoting it online. He was like, "Hey man, what's your favorite song?" And I didn't want to give one that was like obvious or whatever. I just felt like I should give one that was something just sort of like in the cut. And there's a song called off Macadelic called America with Casey Veggies and Joey Badass, which is kind of random, but it just sounds so good. And
the video was so good.
And the video's, oh yeah, amazing. Shout out to Ill Roots.
Yeah.
But he has a line in there where he says,
"I could never die."
No, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry that I'm getting the line wrong. It's something where like legends never die. I just like that a lot.
There's a song off Faces called Here We Go, and the lyrics kind of speak to Mac Miller's legacy for me, because there's a moment where he's like sort of reconciling how critics viewed him in the past versus how people are starting to view him in his present as he's growing and blossoming into this new artist. But then he caps it off like sort of triumphantly saying, "I did it all without a Drake feature." And I think that is so telling of just his career arc, just everything that he was able to accomplish on his own, but also with help from his friends, and the way that he was able to help others to sort of reach their full potential speaks to everything that he was.
By the way, he wanted a Drake feature so bad.
that's what makes it so funny, because he does talk about it in a few interviews, how he would have looked forward to having one. But the fact that he was able to achieve all that he was able to achieve, it sort of stands as this metaphor. Drake being this guy who has been known to sort of pluck artists up and give them a cosign, and Mac being this person who never needed that.
And also, we haven't really talked about Mac as part of like a bunch of larger movements. We haven't really talked about the relationship between the Drake approach to melody and Mac's evolving approach to melody. And like, certainly if you listen to Mac Miller in 2009 and 2010, what you hear is like a pretty formalist, structured rapper. But by the time 2017, 2018 come around, he's a singer.
We re-released our interview from 2015 on our podcast this past week in Remember. reference.
SoundCloud.com/awaste of time.
And in that interview, he keeps breaking in and singing Hotline Bling. And he's just like, I don't know, I just love it. And we're like, all right. Yeah. And it just sticks out now.
I think that there's a moment in that Craig Jenkins profile you were talking about where they're walking around in Manhattan and he's singing ELO to himself. He was just so interested in that toward the end of his career. And one of my standouts, I love his feature that he does on the Earl Sweatshirt song Guild. Their voices are both pitched down. The beat is like super weird. I think it's an Earl Sweatshirt beat. And it's a real weird sounding track, but they're like having so much fun. And the verses are so funny. I think Mac rhymes Myrtle Beach with Fur Elise, which is just amazing. So I love that one. I feel like it's a testament to how much like fun and creativity was going on at that period in his career.
I'm not going to make anybody actually listen to this, but like when I was going through the Mac discography, a song that I had completely forgotten about was there's a remix of Justin Bieber's Boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so good.
I know. Maybe we will. Is it,
and Asher Roth's on that too?
Asher Roth. Your boy.
Yeah. And 2 Chainz.
Your dorm mate.
Yeah.
But yeah, 2 Chainz is on it, and Asher Roth is on it, and Mac Miller is on it. Again, you talk about paths not taken, and it's like a nod. It's like a wink. But it's not real.
Right.
So maybe we'll listen to it. Maybe not. Pedro will decide. But I think we should go out.
Come on, Pedro.
I think we should go out to answer Jeff's cry, anguish cry earlier in the podcast. I think we should go out with Nikes on My Feet. In the Nikes on my feet, keep my cypher complete. That's our show this week. Rest in peace to Mac Miller, and my thoughts are with his friends and family. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your Mac Miller memories at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever Sheldon's laughing about. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headset for Media. We're in a new studio this week, and it's very shiny, and I look forward to breaking it, and we'll be back next week. I'm in LA eating 22 course. Young boss, shit, paper in my pockets. I got a closet filled with shoe boxes. Mom said my spending habit a little bit obnoxious, but a pilot stay fresh up in his cockpit. Used to rock hand-me-downs, now buy some clothes, wear them out, hit the clubs, just pull their cameras out. Living in a dream, they beginning to believe. My hotel smell like cigarettes. If I was your boyfriend, never let you go. I keep you on my arm, girl. You'd never be alone. And I could be a gentleman, anything you want. If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. Young and getting money, all these honeys say they love me. Buddha belly, how I'm lucky, girls be rubbing on my tummy. I can be your man, get you everything you need. Have you ever had a Rollie, Stuart Weissman on your feet? And you can be my queen, couple thousand on the jeans, cause I'm down to do some spending on the women of my dreams. Marvin told us we should get it on, right here in the restaurant. Ain't no point of waiting, baby, I can get you what you want. Leprechaun gold, got leprechaun gold. And I came out hot like I was stepping on coals, but I never got cold, keeping extra long gold for a rainy day, need a vacation, name a place we can go. Where I'm trying to take you, we gon' need a boat. Independent rap shit, my life is like the Beatles though. Invest a big check to make sure you get fresh, cause if I was your boyfriend, I'd treat you like a princess.